Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this special episode, Redefine's managing editor, Donna Winchester, interviews Step Up for Students president, Doug Tuthill, about a landmark education choice bill proposed by the Florida Senate. Senate Bill 48 would consolidate Florida's choice programs and create the ability for families to use their money flexibly on a variety of options that meet their individual needs. Tuthill and Winchester discussed the mechanics behind the bill, how it could empower not only families, but educators as well, how it could drive economic development to underserved communities, and align public education with what social sciences teaches us about learning and internal motivation. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the episode.
So today we're going to do something a little bit different with our Redefine podcast. Donna Winchester, who is the editor of Redefine, is actually going to interview me. We're going to talk about a new bill that's been filed in the Florida Senate that has a big impact on education choice programs in the state of Florida. So with that, Donna, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Doug. How does it feel to be on the other side of the microphone?
A little awkward, but I'm sure I'll work through it.
Well, thank you so much for making the time today to talk about some really important issues. I wanted to start off by asking you a question that it's really been something I've wondered about for the 2 years that I've worked for Step Up for Students. I know that our organization for many years has embraced a slogan, and that slogan is helping public education fulfill the promise of equal opportunity. And I was wondering, to get us started today, if you could explain the genesis of that slogan, how it's guided your philosophy as our organization's leader, and why you think that slogan is still relevant today, possibly even more relevant.
Well, Don, I think equal opportunity is really the core value that brings people together in the Ed Choice movement. You know, from being in Step Up, it's a very diverse group of folks that work in Step Up across the political spectrum, all kinds of different ideologies, all kinds of different beliefs, political affiliations, etc. But one thing that unites us all is our belief that every child deserves an equal opportunity to be successful, an equal opportunity to develop his or her full potential. And that's really the essence of the whole education choice movement. The other thing I think is important is that we've never seen ourselves as somehow outside of public education. You know, every child that's in an Ed Choice program, that program allows them to satisfy the state's mandatory school attendance laws. There's all kinds of different ways you can do that: virtual school, brick and mortar, private school, charter school, etc. So we just see ourselves as part of the continuum of offerings. And so in that sense, we're helping public education fulfill the promise. It's a promise that we've never achieved, but I think it's the promise of public education, which is ensuring that everybody has an equal opportunity. So that's what that phrase is about. It's letting people know that we're in the business of trying to help public education, strengthen public education, and through that, make sure that every child has an equal opportunity to be successful.
Thank you. I've also heard you talk, especially lately, about how education choice empowers and engages families in public schooling. Can you elaborate a little bit on that and explain, you know, how education choice accomplishes that goal?
As you know, I've been in this business a long time, about 42 years in the education business. And I've always been sort of an education reform person, because I've always been driven by that notion of equal opportunity. You know, I was raised in segregated schools. My high school wasn't integrated until my junior year, for example. So I've been exposed to that, you know, most of my life. And so I've always been driven by this notion, like we talked before, about equal opportunity. And one of the things I've learned over the years is that families are really critical. Too often, families feel alienated. They don't feel like they're a part of the school. A lot of families do feel that way, but it tends not to be the case with a lot of low-income families, families of color. They tend to be somewhat alienated. And so I think a lot of what the Ed Choice movement does is it gives people power that historically haven't had it. You know, our programs are targeted primarily towards disadvantaged families, low-income families, families with children who have unique abilities or special needs. And we're really trying to find those families that may not have always felt that sense of ownership, that sense of empowerment, that sense of control, which we know is a natural human desire. And when you don't have that, it causes people to feel alienated. It causes people to feel hopeless. And so what choice does is it empowers people. It makes them have this greater sense of ownership. It helps them feel like there is hope that they can change their situation. And I think that's sort of the magic of choice. People always ask me, how is it that you get such significant student achievement with so little money. You know, most of the scholarships only funding kids about 60% of the funding in a regular district school. And, you know, I think the magic sauce is really this sense of empowerment, the sense of ownership, and the engagement that comes from that.
I know that families are near and dear to your heart, but I also know that there are some people who question whether parents really are the best arbiters of their children's education. How would you respond to those who doubt a parent's ability to make the best educational choices for their children? And what would you say to encourage families?
Well, I'm always discouraged when I hear that comment, because a lot of people have stereotypes about low-income families or minority families. And, you know, I hear occasionally those families either don't care, or those parents, you know, make bad decisions. That's why they're low income. There may be other issues in the family that people look down their nose on. My experience over the years, and I've spent a lot most of my adult life working in on civil rights kinds of issues, working in low-income communities, minority communities, those families love their children as much as any other family does. I think the challenge they have is, you know, they don't always have the resources they need in order to provide the children all the support that they need. But the idea that those families don't love their children, they aren't committed to their children, and don't want the very best for their children, I just think is wrong. And so all the evidence we've had in our program over the last 20 years has been that when you give families an opportunity and you give them a chance really to make a difference in their children's lives, that they act on that. And that's why you see such tremendous growth in our program. I mean, we grow 15,000, 20,000 kids a year, families fighting to get in. And these are families that a lot of people say, well, I don't think they care. I don't think they can make good decisions. And yet we see them fighting to get in the program, going through a very rigorous application process because they do care about their children. And for a lot of families, they understand that breaking the cycle of generational poverty, the key to that is education. Contrary to what everybody believes, we see all this evidence that these families are very committed to their children, and they do make very, very good decisions on behalf of their kids. Human development is a very complex process. And one of the things we do need to do a better job of is giving parents as much support as possible to help them make better choices, particularly as we move into this area of education choice, where there's more and more choices available to families. We'll talk a little bit about the bill that was recently filed that's going to give families a lot more flexibility with their spending. And as they get this additional flexibility, we have an obligation to make sure they have all the support systems they need, to have all the information they need to make better decisions. But the idea that families aren't completely committed to their children and don't have the capacity to look out for their best interests of their children is just not true.
Thank you. I would like to come back to this. I want to circle back, but you brought up the bill. So I think I want to pivot a little bit now and talk specifically about the bill that was introduced. Can you explain a little bit about the impetus behind the legislation and what this bill will do to assist families?
Well, this bill was filed by Florida Senator Manny Diaz Jr., who is a long champion of education choice in Florida, longtime educator, and really a fierce advocate for families and for equal opportunity. Manny's bill does a couple things, and a big advocate, in addition to Senator Diaz, has been the Senate President, Senator Simpson. Senate President Simpson is also somebody who believes fiercely in equal opportunity, and a lot of the motivation behind this bill was parents reaching out to Senator Simpson and just Senator Diaz saying, we need a little bit of help in navigating these programs. So the bill does two major things. One is it streamlines some of the programs that we have today. We have six different Ed Choice programs, primary programs, and this begins to consolidate a lot of those programs, makes it much more user-friendly for families so they can more easily navigate those programs and find the very best option for their children. The other thing it does is it gives families a lot more flexibility. We've learned from the pandemic that families are really looking for a lot more flexibility to make sure they keep their children safe and to make sure they give them the very best education possible. Every family has unique situations. Some have elderly parents, you know, living in the home, or grandparents. There's other kinds of challenges that they have in terms of managing this pandemic. And so we've seen families search for options, whether it's homeschool co-ops, whether it's virtual education, whether it's micro schools, all kinds of different options that families are trying to look to access in order to make sure that they can meet their individual family and child's needs. And so this bill gives families quite a bit more flexibility in how they spend their funds. So if they want to access a homeschool program or a virtual program or a micro school or some combination thereof, which a lot of families are doing now, a combination of brick and mortar and virtual, et cetera, this bill will give families the flexibility to do that. In that sense, I think it's really transformational. It's the next generation of the choice movement, which allows families to have way more choices, just not within schools and between schools, but outside of schools. Because we know that a lot of the learning that happens happens outside of school. We focus primarily on in-school learning, which is obviously critically important. But in all of our lives, a lot of the major events that happen in terms of our learning and our development happen outside of school. For me, for example, it was sports. But participating in sports can be really expensive and difficult to do for a lot of families. And so giving families as much flexibility and much support with these resources begins, again, to level the playing field so that low-income kids have the same options, not just within school, but also start to have some of the same kind of learning options that more affluent families have outside of school.
So in reading the text of the bill, which was quite lengthy, quite robust, it appears that this legislation not only will assist families, but it also has the opportunity to help education providers and perhaps even spark some small business development. Can you speak to that potential?
Well, you know, we have a program now called the Gardner Scholarship, which is an educational savings account. That program is for kids with deep end special needs or unique abilities, spina bifida, Down syndrome, autism. And what we've seen is that it's really provided a tremendous opportunity for the providers who work with those families and those children to begin to offer some additional innovations, different ways to serve those families. And now as Senator Diaz's bill expands that flexibility to probably over 200,000 families, if the bill passes as written, that's a tremendous opportunity for more people to say, okay, how can I provide special services to these families? So I can envision classroom teachers, for example, starting after-school tutoring programs, starting summer enrichment programs. And as we've seen with some of our current programs, small business development has been one of the huge beneficiaries of choice education choice in Florida. And now with this flexibility, they'll be able to create micro schools or special after-school tutoring programs, and low-income families will be able to afford that. So I think you're going to see a building on the small business development that we've seen thus far over the last 20 years with our choice programs, where communities that historically haven't had a lot of economic development start seeing education as a economic engine in their community and as a source of jobs. We've seen a lot of that with schools now, affiliated with churches and other community groups, like I said. But I also can see, like I said, people creating tutoring programs, after school learning programs, summer programs, complementing the in-school learning. So I think that's going to be a huge positive as families have more money to spend. Entrepreneurs are going to come in, classroom teachers are going to come in and really begin to provide those additional options for families.
What do you envision at this moment, especially with this bill, you know, on the horizon? What can education choice advocates do to assist parents in some of the decisions that they might have to make moving forward? You know, what do you think our obligation is, our responsibility is now, in addition to advocating for the passage of this bill to help them make some choices right now?
If this bill passes as it's currently written, there could be up to 230,000 kids on educational savings accounts in the fall. And those accounts, as I mentioned before, give families a lot of spending flexibility. And so part of what we have to do is manage those transactions. And we got to do it in a way that makes sure that public dollars are spent appropriately, but also do it in a way that doesn't minimize the ability of families to have the flexibility they need to meet their children's needs. That's a complex needle to thread. And we actually did a podcast the other day with Joe Fonts and Gina Lynch on our staff talking about the complexities of managing educational savings accounts. So a big part of our challenge at Step Up is to make sure that we build the infrastructure and the support systems and the work processes to make sure that we help families and providers connect and that we minimize the friction between those transactions so it's an effective and efficient experience for both families and providers. The next part of that is also, as you mentioned, trying to make sure we give families all the information they need to make the very best choices possible. We're looking forward to things like families providing reviews for other families to say, you know, I worked with this tutor, I had a great experience. You might want to take a look at that tutor also. So some sharing amongst families and sharing information to help them make better choices. We have an artificial intelligence partner, NLP Logix, that we've had a lot of conversations with about how do we begin to collect data and use that data in a way that can inform algorithms that can give families feedback about, you know, you live in this neighborhood in Tampa, other kids in your situation in this neighborhood who have similar kind of demographics and challenges have made these kind of choices and had these kind of results. No one's going to tell families what to do, of course, but if we can provide more support, more information, that's a big part of our business model moving forward, is trying to make sure that giving families choice is important, making the use of choice funds as easy as possible, but also providing the information so they make the very best possible decisions for their children. As I mentioned earlier, human development is complex. Every child is unique. Not every parent has a PhD in child psychology. And so trying to figure out how to navigate the universe of choices that's expanding dramatically is not an easy task. And so we have an obligation to do everything we can, you know, to help families.
And what about educators? It seems to me that education choice, and especially, you know, some of the really amazing avenues that could open up, you know, with the passage of this legislation, is really going to be a boon for educators as well. How do you see their role expanding and the opportunities that could open up for them as far with innovation and things like that with the passage of this legislation?
Well, Donna, as you know, I spent about the first 15 years of my professional career working as a teacher union activist. I was a president of two different local teacher unions. I did a lot of work at the state level, a lot of work nationally, and even did some work internationally on behalf of the National Education Association in the United States, representing them internationally. And so one of the lessons I learned as a young union activist is how discouraged a lot of teachers get when they get into a large system or even a small system and really have a lot of their enthusiasm, you know, beat out of them. And, you know, we have these large institutions, these large, basically factories, you know, that have their roots in the 19th century and can be very discouraging for a lot of teachers. It's hard to innovate. Teachers always complain about being overregulated, about being micromanaged, about not being able to use their own creativity and innovation. You know, a lot of professions, people can start their own small business. You can start your own accounting firm or your architecture firm or law firm or doctor's office. But for educators, it's really hard. And so you might be really innovative and you might have the entrepreneurial spirit. You might be an amazing teacher and you want to be able to have the freedom to exercise those skills and those motivations. But it's really hard if you're working in a large school district. And so what the choice movement has done is it's opened up the opportunity for educators to be able to do their own thing, to start their own schools, to start their own micro schools, to start their own, you know, after school programs and summer programs. And so a lot of the schools that are in Florida that's servicing our scholarship kids, there's about 2,000 of those schools, as you know. A lot of those schools were started by and continue to be maintained by teachers or principals from district schools who said, I need more flexibility. I need more freedom. I need less regulation. You know, I really can meet the needs of these kids if I have a little more running room to do my own thing. And I think as the Ed Choice movement continues to expand, as families continue to sign up for these programs, as these programs grow, it's going to be a huge boon for educators. A lot of the frustration I saw as a teacher union leader can be addressed if educators have more opportunities to be innovative, not to be as overregulated as they are, to be able to do their own thing, to start their own small business like every other profession can. I think you're going to see a lot of very dynamic educators who normally would be pushed out of the profession because they're so frustrated. I think you're going to see them staying in the profession and creating lots of innovation. I think For the next 15, 20 years or so, you're going to see an amazing amount of innovation that's being driven by educators who have finally had the freedom to be much more creative, and families finally having the resources in order to be able to access those kinds of choices. So I think it's going to be a renaissance, a very exciting time for teachers and for families over the next 15, 20 years as Ed Choice in Florida particularly continues to expand and as families have more flexibility in how to spend their money. I see a lot of the education happening outside of normal school days. You know, we tend to think that the only time people can learn is when they're in a school, brick and mortar school building. And that was true for 100 and some years in terms of our thinking of public education. But public education is really well beyond the school walls today. Certainly with the pandemic, almost all the public education moved outside of brick and mortar for a long time. But I think you're going to see a lot of the change that happened during the pandemic becoming permanent. And that means thinking about education just not within the four walls of a brick and mortar building, but in the community, out in nature, all kinds of ways that people can learn by doing and have experiences outside of the school building, as well as in the school building. So I think that's the kind of renaissance we're going to see. I think it's going to be an amazing period of innovation. Lots of other fields, Donna, have experienced a tremendous amount of innovation, whether it's telecommunications and you know, the internet, and I mean, driverless cars are coming, you know, and all these various things that are transforming our lives. The fact that you and I, you know, are videotaping over the internet and doing this interview over the internet, just one of the examples of how things are changing. Education has historically been very, very resistant to innovation. And I think you're finally starting to see that break up. You're finally starting to see educators and parents having the space they need to innovate. And so I think the next couple of decades is going to be an era of innovation in public education, which we've been waiting for 175 years.
So to bring our conversation back to this really exciting moment in time and in our time, in our history here in Florida, with the introduction of this new legislation that will streamline the process for families and provide more flexibility for them, what would you like to say to our state legislators at this moment?
Well, I want to thank them for their vision and for their courage. You know, we're trying to improve and redefine and reimagine, as you said, an institution that really came to fruition in the 19th century, particularly around the Civil War. It picked up a lot of momentum. It was very much influenced by the manufacturing revolution, Henry Ford, mass production. And we started to build a public education system that was designed to mass produce kids in the same way we mass produce cars and other kinds of manufacturing processes. It turns out that kids aren't cars. It turns out that kids are very unique. And so we really need a public education system that has the flexibility, that has the ability to be flexible enough and innovative enough to really customize a developmental experience for each child. And that lack of standardization, that emphasis on customization, while it's correct, while it's the right way to go, while it's consistent with what we know about human nature and how humans learn and human cognition and social psychology, I mean, it all fits to in what the social sciences tell us. Those changes are very controversial. There are people who have business models and revenue streams that are deeply tied to a top-down command and control public education system. They're very tied to a system that disempowers employees and families. I mean, the union model that I worked in under 15 years assumes a disempowered workforce. You know, it requires a disempowered workforce. It assumes that they need to be taken care of by a union that will take care of them, because they can't take care of themselves because they're disempowered and they're working in this massive factory. So we built the teacher unions modeled after the United Auto Workers and after the steel workers, because those were all big factories and schools looked like big factories. So that's why we organized those kind of unions. And so right now it's tough for a teacher union leader to say, well, you know, I think I'm going to give up my industrial model of unionism and embrace a 21st century model of unionism that empowers educators, that supports entrepreneurship. That is so contrary to the business model of a teacher's union. It's really tough. You know, I have sympathy for union leaders that look at that and say, you know what, that's too hard. That's a bridge too far. I'm not quite going to take that risk. I understand that. But at the end of the day, it's best for everybody. And I really applaud the courage of our legislative leadership to say, you know what, we're going to do what's best for kids. We're going to be criticized in the media. We're going to be criticized by these other groups that have a lot of vested interests in the traditional status quo. But at the end of the day, we have to do what's best for kids. At the end of the day, we have to do what science tells us. Social science says that the current system is really contrary to how kids best learn and how we motivate kids. You know, we destroy internal motivation of the employees and of the students because of how the system is organized. And so legislative leaders in Florida who say, you know what, we're going to build a public education system that's consistent with what we know about how people learn, how people are motivated, what brings people joy in their learning, what brings them joy in their work and as teachers. I just applaud people for having the courage to stand up to do that. And I think eventually, even my friends in the teachers union, even my friends on school boards, eventually, I think they also will feel comfortable enough and secure enough to be able to start to embrace some of the innovations that we're talking about. Because at the end of the day, it's best for all people. It's best for teachers. It's best for kids. It's best for families and parents. And it's best for the overall society. So I think eventually we're going to get there. And I think right now we're at a turning point. And I think the wind's at our back. This bill is one example of that. But I think we're starting to move into a period of time that's going to be an amazing period of renaissance and innovation for public education. And I'm glad I lived long enough to see it, Donna.